The Cycling Podcast, in association with RAFA. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, RAFA exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
I'm actually with Lionel Burney, punching the air. Lionel.
Hello. Hello,
Lionel.
Hello.
And we're joined by Daniel Freeb, television's Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps. How's it going?
Hello.
Podcastings, Buffalo mm-hmm. and Napalm.
Waiting for this.
He's joining us not on the hotline from a secret location in Europe, but on the lukewarm line, isn't it?
Why lukewarm?
I don't know.
It's just a bit crackly.
All right. I thought I sounded very enthusiastic.
Dial up, Daniel. Well, you're energized because you've been to a bike race.
Well, yeah, and energized by the lack of indoor cycling in this week's podcast. Or computer cycling? I don't know. What's the official word?
What about outdoor cycling on grass and mud?
No, not a big fan of that. No. Why? Oh, cyclocross. Yes. We fell in love with cyclocross last year, didn't we?
Daniel.
How could I forget? I'm a big fan of cyclocross. Not an active fan, but I'm not an atheist either. More an agnostic.
It involves
or a non-practicing cyclocross fan. Anyway.
Have you ever, from your running perspective, have you ever analysed sort of how many minutes per kilometre they're running at? You know, what sort of speed they're running at? Are you impressed by that? The fact they're carrying a bike?
Relatively. Again, it's a bit like track cycling in the sense that I fully acknowledge and I'm a big advocate of the benefits that it can bring a road rider.
Hmm.
And in fact, I got quite excited. I know, unlike me to get excited, but I got quite excited when I heard that Zdeněk Stýbar was going to be dedicating more time to cyclocross this winter because I think that will do his riding in the classics the world of good, and I think he'll have a bumper classic season.
What was it like though, Daniel, to be back at a bike race at the weekend there? You were at the Challenge Mallorca. Was it adrenaline pumping? Were you bouncing off the walls with excitement?
I was, Rich. So much so that I got to the start, unfortunately, half an hour late, or half an hour later than I wanted to get there, because it was the weather conditions in Mallorca have been, they were a bit patchy last week. There were a couple of landslides, which caused the organisers to change the route a couple of times, so the start times were messed around with. And we also have this strange format in the Challenge Mallorca where, well, we talked about it last week, didn't we? Where there's this sort of buffet arrangement. You never really know who's riding on which. Well, you know which team they're riding for, but you never know which riders that team is going to pick on a given day, which, you know, adds an element of surprise. So I showed up in the morning, not really... aware of who was going to be riding, but you know, some big names there. Dan Martin was there. Emmanuel Buchmann had won one of the harder of the four legs of the Challenge Mallorca the previous day, and indeed rode very well again on Saturday. He was certainly one of the form riders in Mallorca. Valverde was there, the world champion. So yeah, it was a pretty decent field, not many spectators, very, very low key sort of affair. I was being stopped by tourists saying what the hell's going on here, and they were slightly incredulous when I told them that some of the best bike riders in the world were present and going to be racing that day.
It's incredibly low key watching it. It looked like a club race, really, in contrast to Argentina, Tour de San Juan, where certainly on the final stage there were huge crowds, and I thoroughly enjoyed watching Tour de San Juan. But we'll hear about all of that, and I think we'll also hear a bit later from some people like Katusha. Marcel Kittel got off the mark at the weekend. But Lionel, do you have a news roundup, please?
I do. There's a lot to recap this week. Loads of racing going on. We'll start with the Cyclocross World Championships in Boense in Denmark. The top three in the men's race were as expected. The only question was which order they would finish in, and the answer to that question was that Mathieu van der Poel of the Netherlands got the better of two Belgians, Wout van Aert and Toon Aerts, who finished in silver and bronze positions. It was van der Poel's first world title since 2015, breaking van Aert's run of three. To be fair, though, Richard, you watched the women's race, which, I mean, the men's race was a kind of a formularity. Formularity? Yes.
Formality. Lionel.
Are you joining formulaic and formality together there?
We're doing the podcast in English this week, Lionel.
Anyway, Sanne Kant won for the third year in a row for Belgium. She beat the Dutch women Lucinda Brand and Marianne Vos into third. Richard, there was a real mishap for Lucinda Brand in the pits when she went for a bike change. Her dad was doing the support and basically grabbed the bike too soon, causing her to fall off. Some debate about whether or not that cost her a shot at the gold medal. You watched the race. What did you think?
I saw Neil Rogers of Cycling Tips argue that it didn't cost her the race. And Neil knows a lot more about cyclocross than I do. But Lucinda Brand's a road rider, and I think the finish suited a road rider. And had she arrived there with Sanne Kant, I think she would have had a very, very good chance. She looked really strong, and she was gutted not to win. It was a superb race. You know, six or seven riders were in contention. Riders were making mistakes. They were going off the bat. They were getting back on. It had everything the men's race really didn't. It was a nail biter and a very good winner. Fantastic Vos back there, you know, many times a world champion, seven times a world champion cyclocross, I think. And it was a really competitive, great race. Four Dutch riders up there, but none of them managing to win it. And Brand, as I say, very disappointed. Hoping to get Lucinda Brand on the next Cycling Podcast Femina, so stay tuned for that.
You can ask her about that mishap and whether she thought she was still in with a shout of winning. But Sanne Kant there, three wins in a row. Some success for British riders in the age category races. Ben Tullett won the junior men's race for the second year in a row, and Tom Pidcock won the under.
Glad you mentioned this, Lionel. Glad you mentioned Tom Pidcock's success, because we had a very angry message from somebody close to Tim Pidcock a couple of weeks ago complaining that you hadn't mentioned that he won the World Cup Series when you're in your cyclocross roundup a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, but we don't do under 23 men's race results, do we?
Don't blame the messenger. I'm just passing on what I was, you know.
No, there's an editorial decision that goes into the news roundup.
Sorry, Tom Pidcock.
The editor's decision is final.
We sometimes do minor league Italian roller hockey, but not under 23.
Yeah, I think that might be the week where you mentioned the minor league roller hockey. Adding salt into the wound.
Picking up, Daniel, on your point about crossover between cyclocross and road, Mathieu van der Poel's road team, Corendon Circus, have been invited to ride Omloop Het Nieuwsblad and Gent Wevelgem this spring, so we'll get to see how he goes on the cobbles. In terms of adaptation to road, I would suggest he's some way behind Van Aert at the moment, isn't he? In terms of, certainly Van Aert is going in at a much higher level after the road results he got last year. No wildcard for Paris-Roubaix for Corendon Circus, though. On the road, lots of road racing going on. Daniel mentioned the Challenge Mallorca, four one-day races that aren't quite a stage race. They were won by Jesus Herrada. He won the first race. Remember, he wore the red jersey at the Vuelta last summer for a couple of days. Emmanuel Buchmann won one, as Daniel said. Tim Wellens won the race to Dea, just as he has done for the last 2 years. And Marcel Kittel broke his duck, ended his 11-month drought without a win, first race win in Palma since Tirreno Adriatico last March. There was a memorable debut for Danish rider Rasmus Iversen of Lotto Soudal. He got into the break on the first day, scooped up enough points to take the lead in the King of the Mountains, but then crashed heavily and broke his collarbone. Quite a baptism of fire for the young Danish rider. Also in that crash was Mikkel Landa of Movistar, who also fractured his collarbone. He was due to have an operation over the weekend, so his season is not off to the perfect start. Next stop, Australia and the Herald Sun Tour, where Team Sky really dominated the second half of the race. Owen Doull got his first pro win on stage three when he broke away with his teammate Luke Rowe. Then Dylan Van Baarle and Mitchelton Scott's Nick Schultz really shredded the bunch on the stage to Arthur's Seat. They were two and three quarter minutes clear. Schultz took the stage win and Van Baarle the leader's jersey. And Van Baarle wrapped up the overall win in Melbourne as his Sky teammate Christopher Halverson won the final stage. From there, across to Argentina and the Vuelta a San Juan, where De Koenig Quickstep finally apologised for Ilho Kaiser's conduct last week. Winner Anacona of Movistar unseated Julian Alaphilippe by winning at Alto Colorado. He then held the lead to the finish to clinch the race overall ahead of Alaphilippe. and Oscar Sevilla was third. Sevilla turned pro for Kelme in 1998. He's now 42 years old, almost as old as I am. Gives me hope, this. What could I win this
year? Watch out, Tour de San Juan next year.
Sam Bennett of Bora Hansgrohe enjoyed lead-out duties from his teammate Peter Sagan a couple of times, and it really paid off on the final stage where he won ahead of Colombian Scotsman Alvaro Hodge. Sticking in South America, the Colombian Time Trial Championships, a notable result there for Daniel Martinez of EF Education First. He won the time trial. According to his team boss, Jonathan Vorters, he was hit by a motorbike in training a couple of days before the race. He put 35 seconds into Miguel Angel Lopez and a minute and a half into Egan Bernal, so a real marker for Martinez there. Back in Europe, where the racing kind of carries on this week, the Grand Prix Marseillaise in the south of France was won by Anthony Turgis of Direct Energy. And there was some worrying news for the Bretagne Classic, formerly the Grand Prix Plouay World Tour race in Brittany. Both the men's and women's races faced being cancelled this year when French television threatened to back out. But it seems that those races are going to be back on TV and will be happening.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Our thanks to our headline sponsor, Rafa, for their support of the Cycling Podcast. We are, as always, very grateful to them. They have just launched a range of limited edition flyweight jerseys, which take their inspiration from the cycling heartlands and new frontiers, celebrating a selection of Rafa's favourite riding destinations for their unique scenery, traditional colours, and of course beautiful roads. These are beautiful jerseys, and my favourite one is the Norway one. They've all got the kind of flags or areas, colours in a little band on one of the sleeves, on the left sleeve. And yeah, the Norway one is particularly striking. A lot of these jerseys are similar in a way to the new Education First jerseys, that same kind of tie-dye effect, but they're very nice indeed. Have a look at them at rafa.cc. Well, as you said, Lionel, a lot of racing. I mentioned Cyclocross Worlds, the women's race was a real cracker, but I've been watching a lot of San Juan as well. Argentina, a beautiful country. There's quite an unknown but well-established cycling tradition in Argentina. I think, and I may have said this before in the podcast, I think there may be more velodromes in Argentina than in any other country in the world.
Wow.
Going way back.
Not all of them indoor velodromes.
And not all of them in use. But there was a time in the early last century, when track racing was very, very popular in Argentina, I believe. Someone will correct me on that. But
that sounds like one of those facts that, that you might get in a pub quiz, and someone very confidently... For example, will tell you that the Marquis of Granby is the most popular name of pubs in the United Kingdom. Like I say, with a huge amount of confidence, and then it turns out to be something like the Red Lion. So I suspect that although that is very intriguing and interesting fact, Richard, we'll probably find out that I don't know.
It's not
somewhere,
true.
Somewhere much more predictable and obvious. Malta
has got the most velodromes.
Who knows? But we talk a lot about Colombia, obviously, and its tradition in cycling. Not so much Argentina, but there's a really interesting sort of pattern developing. We used to see a lot of races in the Middle East at this time of the year. There seems to be the center of gravity seems to be shifting west a little, and there's quite a scene now at the start of the year in Argentina and Colombia. And watching the Tour de San Juan, which is in a tiny pocket of what's a huge, huge country, it's a stunning, stunning country, Argentina. Is there not scope to develop a 3-week tour in one of these countries? Or maybe, I don't know, maybe crossing borders, but South America seems like a place where you could have an incredible 3-week tour. I don't know. I mean, I don't know that there's space in the calendar for another 3-week tour.
No, I mean, again, back to my usual old point about the Grand Tours wouldn't be invented if they didn't exist. I don't think there's any need for a 3-week tour, but certainly scope for, you know, 10 to 14 day race. And I think the way the Vuelta a San Juan is going, you know, the field's getting better every year. Teams are embracing it more. We've seen, well, we've got the racing coming up in Colombia now this coming week. And that will be even more impressive, certainly in terms of the number of people watching on the roadside, because, you know, Colombia really is the hotbed. But yeah, why not? I mean, the old, well, the Vuelta a Colombia is still going, isn't it? But it's not really in a slot on the calendar that would attract the top teams. But why not have a big stage race that really attracts everyone who's everyone in the early part of the year? Maybe not late January, but maybe late February or something like that.
As for the racing, Sam Bennett, I mean, he lost out on stage, I think it was stage one when Gaviria won. Gaviria won a couple of stages, so he's got his time at UAE off to a good start. Bennett, it looked like Bora Hansgrohe were trying really hard to give him a stage win. Daniel, you spoke to Sam Bennett back in December at the Bora Hansgrohe training camp, and he was pretty disconsolate there about what happened at the team. His missing out on a place at the Giro, having won three stages last year. Well, let's hear a little bit what he told you when you spoke to him in December.
Got it. Like, I performed really well there. Made my name as one of the biggest sprinters in the world, and I get my last 12 sprints in a row in the Giro, never outside the top three. The consistency was there. I know the race. I know how to win there. I feel like, what did I do wrong?
Yeah. You're not German.
Yeah, I can't help that. I'm not from a big nation, so yeah, it's not nice.
Well, that was Sam Bennett, and I mean, he's a very honest guy, and couldn't really help himself from telling you exactly how he felt, Daniel, about missing out on the Giro this year, and feeling that he'd slipped down a little bit in the pecking order at Bora Hansgrohe. It did look like the team were trying hard to set him up, Peter Sagan in particular, which suggests that relations, at least, are good at the team, and Bennett will get chances this year. And he told you as well that he's wanting to sort of reinvent himself slightly as a rider for more challenging races, not just a sprinter, but somebody who can get over climbs as well.
Yeah, I mean, you hope that they aren't just throwing him some sort of consolatory crumbs early in the season just to keep him on side, and that Sagan will duly take his place as the leader, or Pascal Ackermann will take on sprinting duties whenever, you know, there's a big prize up for grabs. You know, it was interesting even reading Sam Bennett's comments after the Vuelta a San Juan, talking about the added pressure of being led out by Sagan. He certainly wasn't, well, he didn't sound as delighted as one might expect to be led out by Peter Sagan. But, you know, he's going to have to take whatever opportunities come his way. The big unknown still, I think, is Milan San Remo. I was given the impression when I went to the Bora Hansgrohe team camp in December that he would possibly ride Milan San Remo and that he would possibly be an option for them at that race. But, of course, Sagan has never won it. Sagan is 29 now, and it's a big hole in his palmarès, and you'd probably be quite pessimistic about Sam Bennett's chances of getting a
well, I mean, that's the, you know, the opposite of the kiss of death, isn't it, being written off by Daniel. watch out for Sam Bennett.
Well,
we've become very blasé about Sagan, don't we, and just his consistency. But there he is, started the season again, Tour de l'Under, he's always just exactly the same. It's you know, it's so commonplace that we don't even comment on it anymore. But his level of performance is unbelievably high all the time.
Well, his worst level of performance is higher than some riders' best level of performance, you know, once into racing, certainly.
It looks easy for him. I mean, even setting up Sagan, it was like Messi dribbling around 10 players and then squaring the ball across the goal for someone to tap it in.
It always impresses me more, Rich, as well, because of his physique. I mean, he's the kind of guy who, if you look at him, he's relatively heavy, and you always imagine that riders like him would possibly have more issues with their weight in the closed season than others. That's possibly wrong, in the sense that for Sagan, power-to-weight ratio is less of an issue because he's winning on flatter courses. But he did have some issues with weight early in his career. I remember speaking to Paolo Slongo, who's his coach at Liquigas, about how he in the winter would tell Sagan to go out for a walk in the morning before he even had breakfast to, I don't know whether to sort of get his metabolism up and running. I don't know whether that made
constitutional.
I don't know whether that made too much of a difference, but that consistency is remarkable, particularly as well when Sagan is someone who, you know, will be invited to dinners, to make public appearances throughout the winter. And I think for guys like that, it's particularly difficult. But there's never really been a period in Sagan's career when he has had to spend a month or more losing weight and just to get to something like his usual level. I mean, I suppose the closest he came to that was the Vuelta last year, where he hadn't really raced much after the Tour de France and struggled at the start of the Vuelta. But otherwise, like you say, his consistency has been remarkable.
We were talking about pub quizzes earlier. Another pub quiz question would be would really puzzle people. What do Lionel Burney and Peter Sagan have in common? They're both invited to a lot of dinners.
Oh, I'm never invited to any dinners.
Anyway, another rider who caught everybody's eye at Tour de San Juan was Remco Evenepoel.
Evenepoel. Remco Evenepoel.
It's funny, Daniel, you mentioning that Sagan is almost 29, or is 29. Is he almost 29? Is he 29 yet? He's just turned 29, and it seems like yesterday that he was a 19-year-old emerging talent, and there his career's kind of entering its final straight, perhaps. There's Evenepoel, 19, just turned 19. We weren't expecting a lot from him, but he delivered quite a lot, and he showed, I think, in that race, not the highest level, perhaps, but we're going to see a bit of him this year, I think, aren't we? I mean, the talent is there to see, especially in the time trial.
Well, we talked a couple of weeks ago, Rich, about precedents of riders turning pro very early. In Felipe Pozzato's case, going straight from junior category to the pro category, and how he'd been given a very sort of soft racing program in his first year, indeed his first couple of years. I don't think that's going to be the case with Evenepoel, is it? It looks as though, although he probably won't do that many race days, I think De Koenig and Quickstep have said around 50. It looks as though he is going to be competitive amongst World Tour professionals, whether they're World Tour racers or not, remains to be seen.
Yeah, I think it's important just to bear in mind the context of these early races. I mean, the big names are at the fore, you know, Julian Alaphilippe, Nairo Quintana was up there overall as well. But they're not at their peaks, are they? They're going to be a fair way off their peaks. And the real proof of the pudding will be how Evenepoel gets on in something like the Tour of Catalonia at the end of March, because that's a level up from I think his next races are Algarve and the UAE Tour, and Catalonia is a proper race where the stage racers are really starting to build themselves up, some for the Ardennes Classics, some for the stage races to come. So I think with somebody who's only just 19, it's important just to dampen down expectations a bit, because we don't want to be here in sort of 4 or 5 years' time doing a podcast on where did it all go wrong for him, do we?
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by The Economist. The Economist is a smart guide to the forces impacting your world. And if you would like to get a free print copy of The Economist delivered to your door, if you're in the UK, that is, then text the word cycling to 78070. The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from world politics and business to science, technology, the arts, the environment, and even sport. It's been a trusted source of intelligence for over 170 years, and it's for the kind of person who never stops asking questions and wants to know why the world is the way it is. Richard, you've been reading The Economist this week. What has sparked some questions for you?
First of all, Lionel, I'm impressed that you didn't spell out the word cycling for the listeners to the cycling podcast this week. That was good. The article that caught my eye was, it was a sports article. It was about concussion, looking at two sports in particular, American football and rugby. But it's an issue that is very prominent in cycling as well. And there's some particular difficulties in the sport of cycling with head injuries and diagnosing those head injuries, because riders can't really step off the field of play to be diagnosed. They want to get back on their bikes as quickly as possible. And it's a very, very pertinent issue. And I know that a lot of teams now have concussion protocols and so on. I'm sure that we'll return to this this year. But the article is really interesting about some of the trends and about the difficulty in diagnosing concussion compared to most injuries. Also the fact that second impacts are extremely dangerous if the concussion isn't diagnosed properly in the first place. Another point that's pertinent to sport is that the human brain doesn't finish developing until your mid-20s. So obviously young sports people are particularly vulnerable to the long-term effects of head injuries. And in American football and rugby, there has been a drop in participation. 6% in the US of kids, high school kids, playing American football in the last decade. And in England, 30% fewer children aged 11 to 15 playing rugby in England. And The Economist wonders whether fewer enthusiastic young players could eventually lead to fewer lifelong fans. It's quite a big article in The Economist on concussion in sport, and lots of interesting details in there.
Very interesting, yeah. Well, to read The Economist, get a copy delivered to your door, text the word cycling, not
going to spell
it out.
How are you spelling that,
Lionel? The normal way, 78070.
A very unscientific poll of velodromes, Richard. I can see that Australia and Japan certainly have more velodromes
than
Argentina.
Okay. Correction. Live correction corner.
I'm a bit of an authority on the on fruit production in various countries across the world.
What's that got to do with velodromes?
Well, but very similarly, Rich, I often get that wrong. I'll amaze everyone by telling them that Italy is the world's number one producer of kiwi fruits, and then someone will say, "Well, hang on, what about nectarines?" And I think I know the answer to that as well, and I'll follow that up with, "Well, it's, you know, everyone knows that's Papua New Guinea." And I usually get it wrong. The follow-up is usually wrong, and everyone then looks very deflated when it proves that I'm not the authority that I thought I was, or they thought I was. Anyway.
Well, listeners, if there's any correlation between fruit production and velodromes, let us know.
What about lemons, Daniel?
I don't know. I'm a bit rusty on this line.
I think Lionel must know the answer to this.
No, I don't. Answers on a postcard.
Now, Daniel, we mentioned at the start that you've been at an actual bike race, the Challenge Mallorca. Well, how was it? I mean, as I mentioned earlier, I watched a bit of it on TV, and it is very low-key. For such a cycling-mad island, it's surprising to not see some crowds. And, you know, even the body language of the riders, there's a sense that it is almost like a training race rather than an actual race.
Yeah, it's actually quite a difficult race. The courses are pretty tough. Certainly the first 3 days were very tough, were made even more difficult by the weather. It was unseasonably windy. And despite that, you know, we saw the kind of cream rise to the top. Tim Wellens, as you said, has won the race to Daya, or as Lionel said in his news roundup. I think this was the third time, was it?
Third in a row,
and you know, Wellens is someone who goes really well at this time of year, but he's obviously a class act. It was interesting, when I was at the Red Lotto Soudal training camp a couple of weeks ago, I was just speaking to some guys about Wellens, and he's someone who is very realistic about his sort of place in the solar system of world stars in the sport, and he knows that he's probably not going to win the biggest races in the sort of the kind of main hotspots of the classic season and the Tour de France. So he focuses really on kind of picking the low hanging fruit in the early part of the season and towards the end of the season. If you look at his career, he's had huge success sort of in February and March, and from sort of late August onwards, and he's done that on a consistent basis. And I don't think that he's going to alter his approach anytime soon. So he's already in very good form and attacked from a long way out when he actually attacked behind Buchmann on that day to where the finish was in day. It's the hardest day of the Challenge Mallorca. And Buchmann had won the previous day and he's obviously going very well. The big sort of take home with him, I think, Emmanuel Buchmann, who's going to do the Tour de France this year as the leader, the GC leader for Bora, is that he is really on a very much an upward trajectory in his career. Last year, he was a lot bolder than he'd been in the past. He's a climber who is not terribly explosive, has been someone who has followed generally in major races, had some good results, was the best young rider in the Dauphiné a couple of years ago, was finished well inside the top 10 at the Dauphiné last year. But the difference was that Buchmann was starting to ride quite aggressively, and on Saturday in the Challenge Mallorca, he attacked from a very long way out and almost pulled off his second straight win. So it's going to be interesting to see what he does over the next few months. So again, he's not a guy who's blessed with sort of great kind of attacking speed or great explosiveness. He's not a guy who I think will be a threat for the podium at the Tour de France, but he's someone who's grown in confidence and getting better every year. I was quite surprised that Valverde didn't win on any of the days that he competed in Mallorca. Rode well, rode as Valverde always does, aggressively, and maybe got his timings wrong slightly. He didn't take home any victories, which I thought was a bit of a surprise.
Just on Tim Wellens, you make the point, Daniel, that he goes well at the beginning of the year and at the end. Of course, 2 years ago, 2017, he had pulled out of the Tour de France with a combination of heat and pollen allergies, suffered pretty badly in the hot weather, refused a TUE to take medication to try and alleviate those symptoms. But last year, he was very impressive in the spring. He, as we said, won that same stage of the Challenge Mallorca. He then won the Ruta del Sol. He was fifth at Paris-Nice and then won Brabantse Peel, sixth at Amstel Gold, seventh at Flèche Wallonne, and then 16th at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which was, he wasn't really in the mix at all in the final sort of 25, 30 kilometres, but a good performance. So, you know, I think he's got the capability to go a little bit better than that this spring. Maybe maybe Amstel Gold, maybe, you know, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, the new finish might, it's going to certainly shake up the race, make it very different to what we've become used to. Tim Wellens, when the season gets going and the hot weather comes.
Won a Cita Giro as well the last year, didn't he, on Sicily?
He did.
Yes, he did.
He's a rider who very much knows his place, knows who he is. I mean, he's someone you can look at his palmarès and think, well, why isn't he moving to taking the logical next step of trying to become a GC rider or really focusing everything on Liège-Bastogne-Liège, saying it in the press and really not doing a whole lot before that, behaving like a real sort of bona fide big hitter. But as I said, I think he's realistic and pragmatic and knows that his best chance of success is doing what he currently does, which is picking up wins and being very prominent at times of the year when the real big beasts have not yet come out to play.
Who did you speak to in Mallorca, Daniel?
I suppose this sounds like an interrogation. the recorder didn't come out in Mallorca on Saturday, Rich, mainly because I kept being detained by people who wanted to speak off the record. I was actually party to what might have been some cheating in Mallorca, but of course the omerta prevails, and I can't reveal who it was. We've actually reported this to the UCI, and they're investigating as we speak.
Can you tell us the nature of the incident? Please.
Well, first, I'd like you to clarify. You two might know the answer to this better than I do. Is there an obligation to complete the full distance of the neutralized zone in races?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, it's not called the neutralized zone for nothing. The race has not actually started, has it, in the neutralized zone? So I think that would matter in a big in a really big race. I suspect at the Challenge Mallorca, perhaps not so much. Why? Why, Daniel?
Well, I'll tell you what I saw. Do you know that a rider
didn't complete the neutral zone?
I tell you what I witnessed. I was speaking to a rider, Rich, on Saturday, an unnamed rider, and I became aware that about 800 meters away, the rest of the peloton had already lined up, and the start time was drawing perilously near. I told the unnamed rider that he should probably get a move on. He was doing that when the heavens opened, and we found ourselves under a monsoon. At that point, he said, "Well, I'm just going to take shelter." And we moved our conversation to under a nearby shop awning. And he announced that he wasn't going to bother going to the start at that point. He was just going to wait for the peloton to go past and join the peloton. In as inconspicuous a manner as possible. And that's what he proceeded to do. So he skipped about 800 meters of the neutralized zone.
Wow.
Did this rider feature in the results of the day?
Not terribly prominently, I would say.
I'm guessing he wasn't a Cofidis rider, because you've seen him a mile off in their garish new kit. So we can rule out Cofidis.
Anyway, Rich, I think we should say no more about this incident pending.
It also means it's difficult for you to answer my original question, isn't it, about who did you speak to at the Challenge Mallorca?
Pending the UCI investigation.
Who else did you speak to at the Challenge Mallorca, apart from this rider, this unnamed rider?
Well, I spoke to a lot, as I said, Rich, I spoke to a number of unnamed riders who fed me information on subjects which can't be discussed.
Oh, this is wonderful for the podcast.
Quality podcast material, this.
Brilliant. Yeah, brilliant. Imagine if Lionel had come back from the De Kooning Quickstep camp saying, "Well, I spoke to a lot of unnamed riders about things that I can't discuss."
Well, I did get one very big interview that we now can't use, probably.
No, we're still hoping to use it once the dust has settled a bit. But, Daniel, you did, yes, when you were at the Katusha Alpecin camp in December, you spoke to them.
Oh, that was a different kettle of fish.
Yeah, you know, I was not suggesting it was a Katusha rider.
I was interviewing riders left, right and centre at Katusha. In Mallorca before Christmas, they had their training camp, as they always do, at Club Robinson on the east side of the island just before Christmas. And of course, Katusha coming off a very bad, a very unsatisfactory 2018 season. They won, I think, four races last year.
Five.
Which is five races.
You've got to count Tony Martin's national championship time trial as well.
Well, it was a terrible return, wasn't it? Kittel, of course, had a bit of an annus horribilis. Martin himself didn't pull up any trees, and indeed has left the team. And, facing some difficult questions, I think, going into 2019. Needed a bit of a rethink. Needed to shuffle some things, get some new riders, address some areas of the roster where they were pretty weak in 2018. That's what they've certainly tried to do. So just before Christmas, I discussed this with their team manager, Jose Acevedo, and I think we'll hear from him now, Rich.
Everybody knows the value of this team. It was not what we show along the year. Everybody finished the season frustrated, disappointed. At the end, the management of the team, we analyzed the year. We analyzed the reason of, or the possible reasons for have so bad season, and we decide to make a few changes on the team, and hope now in 19 we are back at the success. If you analyze the riders we bring in the team, they have different characteristics, different skills, and what we want is have a team more competitive in a different race. For example, we signed Battaglin because it's a faster rider. He can win when the finals are short, uphills and steep, And you also can do classics, like for example Dardenne or Amstel Gold Race. It's a good race for him. It's not because we don't have in the team riders who can do it. Nathan Haas is a good rider for this race, but if we can have more riders as an option, more strong gonna be the team. The case of Jens de Boucher, it's a sprinter, and we want to have another sprinter in the team. We want to have we have Marcel, but you know, it's so many races all along the year, and we do all the time two programs, sometimes three, so we want to have always a sprinter in the race. And Jens, we trust on him, is a strong sprinter. He won race, and it's also a strong rider in the classics, and this year he finished three times top 10 in the Cobblestones Classic. So it's for the group of the classics, I think it's also we have a group stronger. For the mountains, we don't lose climbers, but we had and we have now Nabar, a rider with a lot of experience. When he have his possibilities, he can finish top 10 in some race, and he have a lot of experience, and we know when Ilnur need in the big race, when he's in the climbs, he have one more rider who's going to be close to win.
Marcel Kittel is obviously one of your star riders. You've brought Eric Zabel in to work also with Marcel. Can Eric bring about a big change in Marcel, or does the main change have to come from Marcel himself?
For me, Marcel, it's still be the best sprinter in the world. When Marcel is at this top shape, it's difficult somebody beating. Eric Zabel come in the team because it's we create in our structure a new department, the performance department, and Eric is the performance manager. He's responsible for everything with about the performance, the material. So it's his responsibility. But of course, he have a lot of experience. He was on his period, also one of the best sprinters in the world, and for sure he can, with his experience, with his knowledge, he can pass this to the riders. The riders have a lot to, they can learn a lot from him, and like I said, if we have the best to working with us, I think for the riders is much better, you know, because at the end it's. They need to have also good support from the team, but they also need to have a good message. This is why we try to bring in the team people with experience, people with good professional, because at the end, the training is important, but it's many things around that are important. And for example, talking about the sprints, you know how... How much time it need to be invest to create a good lead out train, create a good plan for the sprint, analyze the kilometers before the sprint. So we need to have somebody who can study this. Of course, we have a lot of we have five sport directors with the experience. But if we can have a person like Eric, who was one of the best sprinters in the world, he have a lot of experience and knowledge to pass to the team.
And is Marcel, or has Marcel been complicated to work with?
No, it's not complicated. You know, here in the team we are 70 persons, around 70 persons, and each one have his character, his personality. At the end, we need to respect, but like we speak before, we have one philosophy and one identity. So everybody who come need to go in this spirit and understand our team. But with Marcel, no, we never have problems. Of course, he have a difficult year. He come here after winning five stages in the Tour, big expectations from everybody, and he also from himself. And you know, when you come in the team, everything is new for you. You want to show that, give back the confidence to the team. Sometimes you put this pressure on you. Some periods of the year he was sick, and then you know he lose training, and then he start training again to come back and get sick again. So you have the sprint time. It was not easy, and you know for the riders how important are the results, but for a sprinter it's. they only count the victory. And for many reasons, you know, the year passed. You know, for example, the first stage in Dubai, when Marcel was at the sprint on the side, I think it was with Grunwegen. He had a problem, the chain went out. And then one day, 2 days later, he was blocked. So, you know, it's one chance you lose, another chance you lose, and then you start seeing, you start losing the confidence, then come these healthy problems. And you see the time running and race that you expect have victories, you don't have. It was, not the perfect year, but no, we cannot say Marcel. It's a person who creates problems inside the team. I think everybody in the team like him and respect him.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast and for supplying our listeners with so many sports nutrition products. You can get your 25% off with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. That's SISCP25 at the checkout. This week's question for Ben Samuels at Science and Sport comes from Phil from Swansea. And Phil is the first questioner to phone in his question. I'll give you the number after we've heard his question and Ben's response.
Hi, my question for the Science and Sport guys is, recently I've had to change my diet and go gluten-free. And for my cycling, that's caused a bit of a problem. I generally like to have kind of bread products in my back pocket when I'm going on a long ride, and I've had to cut those out. So I'd like some ideas of suggestions for alternatives that are going to keep me going while I'm on a long ride. Thanks.
Hi Phil, it's a really interesting question, as it doesn't have to be as restrictive as it first appears. Fueling cycling performance is definitely possible on a gluten-free diet. The same principles would apply in that you're aiming to fuel with 60 to 90 grams of carbohydrate per hour on the bike when you're out on those tough, longer rides. The Science in Sport gel range is gluten-free, as are the hydro tablets and Go Electrolyte powder. That gives you a gel, hydration and sports drink options that would all be suitable for yourself. To then replace that sandwich or provide a food-based option to eat while you're on the bike, I suggest looking into making your own rice cakes. It's something that's pretty widespread in professional and amateur cycling, and most rice in its natural form is gluten-free. You could use honey, chopped nuts, stevia or jams to flavour your rice cakes with. That's if you've got a real sweet tooth. Alternatively, you could make those into savoury rice cakes. Fat-free cream cheese tends to be the gluten-free, and that's really the option that's used to bind all your ingredients together and set them into the rice cake.
So that was Ben Samuels answering Phil from Swansea's question. If you would like to send a question for Science and Sport to answer, you can email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Or, as Phil did, you can leave a voice memo, a WhatsApp voice memo, if you dial the number +447971338205. That's +447971338205. It won't take phone calls. It's not Lionel's number I've just given out, or Daniel's, but it will take voice memos through WhatsApp. So leave your question that way if you'd prefer.
Yeah, it's interesting, Daniel, when you look at their roster, they've got Marcel Kittel, who usually should guarantee them X number of wins per season. Surely can't have a year as bad as last year again. And Ilner Zakarin, you would think, would guarantee them a decent position in one of the Grand Tours. Other than that, I mean, Simon Spilak does week-long stage races, never rides the Grand Tours, doesn't like them, doesn't want to do them, usually pulls out a bit of a result at the Tour of Romandy or Tour de Suisse. And everyone else is kind of, they're not prolific, are they? And it's interesting looking at some of the riders they brought in, Enrico Battaglin, who won a stage of the Giro. Who else did they bring in? Debuchir as well. I mean, they're kind of middle-of-the-road sort of signings. It's a team that is going to be very much dependent on whether or not Marcel Kittel can win some big World Tour races.
I think you're absolutely right, Lionel. And there is a misapprehension that Katusha Alpecin is a very rich team, and this is really a hangover or that's a relic of this idea that people have of a previous incarnation of the of the team. Originally, they were very well funded, had a huge budget, similar to Team Sky's budget. They didn't necessarily always get the same kind of results that Team Sky have got out of that budget. But in the last couple of years, they've really had to downsize operations, and I think they're operating now at around about the sort of 15 million euro a year level, or even less than that. So they've not got an awful lot to work with, and I think Kittel probably sucks up a fair amount of the budget. Kittel is a guy who, as we've talked about in the past, works on or feeds off momentum, and he needs that early in the season to carry him through, and he needs to be riding with confidence. He needs to have a lot of confidence in his lead out. I think the addition of Eric Zabel will be great for Kittel. Zabel was very effective, or Mark Cavendish certainly thought he was very effective as an advisor at HTC Columbia a few years ago, and obviously, you know, being German and being someone who faced a lot of the pressures that Kittel is now facing, Zabel is ideally placed to help him out. Elsewhere in the roster, I think in the classics they'll be relatively strong. I think Niels Pollitt is someone who is getting better every year. He was 7th in Paris-Roubaix last year, 17th in Flanders, so he's a consistent performer, and he's someone in his mid-20s who should be getting better every year. But otherwise, you know, it's a team that I think might struggle. As you said, there aren't there isn't a huge number of bankers there. Simon Spilak is someone who, by hook or crook, has managed to pull out good results in week-long stage races. But in those week-long stage races, he's not generally been the best time trialist or the best climber. He's just a very canny operator who really stakes everything on three or four races every year, the Tour of the Basque Country, Tour of Romandy, Tour of Switzerland, that kind of race. And it has often worked out for him, but didn't last year. I mean, it's contract year for him this year, so he's under a bit of pressure. He might well contrive and manage to pull out something again in those races, but it's far from a guarantee. And, I think looking beyond this year, and there are probably questions about Katusha's future. They've got a new business model. They've had a new business model for the last couple of years. They want to be certainly to a degree self-sustaining. Now they have, Katusha is a sportswear brand and a sportswear manufacturer, and they're hoping to raise a decent amount of capital from sales of that sportswear. Not sure how well that is going. I think Acevedo is a very hands-on manager as well. He's got a lot on his plate. He's someone who gets involved in the real nitty-gritty of how the team operates. But you compare the sort of human resources that Katusha have got to a Team Sky, and you see, I think, probably big differences, where people are having to multitask and do a lot of different things. And pulling off the kind of thing that Sky is able to do, or what Jumbo Visma are doing now in the Netherlands, is not as easy as just having the will to do it. You also need the money. You take the example of their training camp, Katusha's training camp in Mallorca. You know, there were a couple of not grumbles, but one or two of the riders did mention the fact that it wasn't ideal for the climbers, because they were right on the east side of the island where there aren't a lot of climbs. And Ian Boswell sort of said to me, well, that's the kind of thing that, you know, at Sky maybe you would have someone to drive the climbers to the other side of the island, and that would have quite a big effect on the training camp. But at Sky, that's affordable, that's doable, that's feasible. It's not necessarily at a lesser funded team. So, they've got facing a bit of an uphill battle, I think. But again, as is the case with Kittel, if they get some momentum early in the season, then they have got some talented riders who could surprise us.
Yeah, I mean, there's no ambiguity now, is there? I mean, with Tony Martin leaving, there's no one to kind of deflect the responsibility from Kittel. I'm sure he's acutely aware that he can't perform like he did last year. And when you look at their roster, I mean, they have got they've got enough speed and enough horsepower to put together a decent lead out train for him and you know, keep races under control and you know, maybe join in with De Koenig, Quickstep and the others who will be trying to bring races back together for sprint finishes. So yeah, it's going to be an important spring for Kittel but the big thing is for a rider of his stature, it's the size of wins really that counts. He needs to be back on top winning at the Tour de France.
And they had a bit of a reboot last year, became a more international team last year. One of the riders who joined last year was Ian Boswell, and I think you spoke to him as well, didn't you, Daniel?
I did, Rich. I spoke to him about that. What exactly is the identity of Katusha now in terms of nationality, and also about this theme that Jose Acevedo mentioned, and we heard him talk about a minute ago, the difference in the way Katusha are trying to pick their teams for races this year. They're trying to base that a lot more on form and current fitness rather than sort of premeditated racing programs that they came up with over the winter. So this is Ian Boswell talking about those two subjects.
You know, the team has made some changes this year that was pretty clear from the start, and I guess already at the end of last year that, you know, things were changing, and we brought in some new coaching staff and brought in, I want to say Rick Zalba, Eric Zalba, I always get him confused, but yeah, Eric Zalba's in here for a performance coach, and I think just coming off like a pretty, you know, disappointing year all around. I mean, I wasn't necessarily super disappointed, but I think, you know, the team and the management and the sponsors definitely expected more. I think the mood within team camp is already, you know, people are working hard from the get-go, which has been a clear sign. I mean, last year we had a great team camp. It was super fun. Everyone was enjoying themselves.
I was about to say, because I remember reading at the time, I think it was the same location, even in Mallorca, and a lot of new guys in the team last year. And, you know, you always get a good vibe, positive messages coming out of a team camp, but it really did seem as though something sort of not special then new and exciting was forming, and then, like you say, it was pretty disappointing in some respects.
Yeah, I think that's completely correct. I think that we did have a really good, I came to this team, you know, from being at Sky for 5 years, and I was like, wow, this is like really cool environment, like everyone was super happy, and really did feel like a family, and it was, you know, professional but also really relaxed, and but yeah, the results didn't come until kind of throughout the year the tension was building that, you know, we needed to kind of get our ass in gear, to, you know, to put it a straight way. And yeah, this year it's been a lot less kind of horsing around. It's like, if we have, you know, a 6 hour training ride, it's a 6 hour training ride. It's not, you know, 5.5 or 4.5. But everyone's motivated as well. You know, I think from the guys who had a disappointing year to also, you know, the new riders on the team who, you know, speaking with Enrico Battaglin, is that correct? You know, he had a great year last year. He won a stage in the Giro and had some other good results. So it's not, you know, I think for the riders like that to come in and see kind of that the team's motivated, you know, continues to push those guys forward as well.
You mentioned changes to coaching staff. I know it's very early and you might not even have sort of embarked on the programs you've been set yet, but what are the main differences you can see already and from the old regime to the new regime?
I guess kind of an overall focused approach for the whole team and just making sure that everyone is, you know, kind of push. I mean, speaking of, I was with in the same group as Danny Navarro, who's been pro for 15 years now. He turned pro in 2006, and just seeing how cycling has changed and evolved over those years. You know, he said if they didn't start, his old teammates and team leaders didn't start training until January, you know, in 2006. And here we're, you know, early December. The sport as a whole has changed. You know, you used to be able to show up to, you know, an early season race like Mallorca Challenge, and it was important, but you could kind of just get through and you could, you know, race in leg warmers and you could ride back to the hotel, and there wasn't a lot of pressure. But I think especially coming off the year we had, I think there's a little bit of pressure from the beginning of the year. And you know, one thing we've implemented this year as a team is like sending the best riders to the races. So rather than having like a fixed program where, you know, your program's set in December and that's your program throughout the year, that, you know, if you're not riding well, then there's no point in sending you to races, which is something that, you know, is clear, you know, makes a pretty clear choice that, you know, your training is going to be analyzed and, you know, watched. So they're sending the best riders to the races.
That's pretty unusual, isn't it, in the context of the World Tour? I've not really heard of teams doing that before.
Team Sky did that. I think a lot of riders at Sky received their race program last minute, and that was one of the things I actually really enjoyed last year at this team, was having a pretty fixed race program. And, you know, being, I would say, usually a relatively motivated rider, that I, you know, was focused to show up at the races prepared, and not just like riding through knowing my race program. So it creates a competitive, you know, edge within a team that riders aren't necessarily competing with each other for spots, but that riders are pushing each other to make sure that you're ready for races. You're not just turning up because you know, we're told in December that you're doing a race in July so you can show up.
And presumably those judgments about who is going well, who is not, some of the time it's based on training data.
Yeah, I think a lot of it's based on training data. And, you know, we have, yeah, I'm seeing him walking over there, Dirk De Mol's here, who has a lot of experience. And same with, like I said, Eric Zobel, and also with Kevin as a new trainer. I think they're going to be doing a lot more kind of scientific analysis of riders' performance and training.
And Ian, it's a team with a very sort of multinational identity. In the history, recent history of cycling, sometimes that's worked incredibly well. HTC, it worked incredibly well. It was a team with no sort of obvious single national identity. At Quickstep, it seems to work pretty well. They've got a lot of riders from different nationalities. How much did that contribute to the difficulties the team had last year, or how much can it contribute to the strength the team might have in the future?
Yeah, I think you're completely right. I think you did see, or you've seen teams in the past, or even like you said, Quickstep, that have come together being a very international team and performed. And, you know, the only World Tour team I have experience with was Sky. And I felt that they, although being an international team, they definitely have a very British core. And I think that core, for myself being a young rider, like those were the cool guys. Like the good riders were also like the cool guys, like Thomas and, you know, Froome and Luke. And, you know, when Swifty was there and Pete Kennen, you wanted, well, I mean, personally, I guess I can speak from my own experience. I wanted to fit in with those guys. So I wanted to be part of that group because those were the guys going to the big races. And you know, I wanted to show those guys that I was a good rider and reliable. We don't necessarily have that same kind of group at this team because it's so international. We don't have one national identity that's kind of, I don't want to say favored, but kind of the core group of guys who've been racing together for a long time who are tied in with the coaches and the staff. It's very international.
The Germanic group not taking over slightly?
They are. It's definitely the most dominant kind of influence in the team. But at the same time, it's not really, I guess I'm not part of the sprint lead out train, so I don't really see it as much, but it is, I would say in all senses, it's a really international team, and your nationality doesn't really dictate your race program or kind of who you're friends with on the team. So it's nice in that sense that everyone gets along and there's not really like a clique within the team. But at the same time, like, I do sometimes see a benefit of a team having kind of a national identity. So it's a fine balance of, you know, keeping it international, but making that work and bringing everyone together for a common goal that's, you know, getting people to race for each other, even though they might not have, you know, a native tongue.
So that was friend of the podcast, Ian Boswell. That was interesting to look at Katusha. Momentum, as you said, is so important for Marcel Kittel. It's also so important for teams, you know, and there are a few teams. Just looking at the early results, there are teams that had shockers last year: UAE, Emirates, Education First, Alpecin, Katusha Alpecin, who are all off the mark. And that's so important to get some early wins, and not so much for the wins, but more for the feeling it engenders within the team. And
it can be rich. It can be, but it can also sort of dissipate and dissolve relatively quickly.
I remember last year,
early loss. Exactly, that's exactly what I was about to say. People raving about all the changes that have been made there, new riders, new approaches, and it was only a month or two later when people were talking about a crisis.
Nevertheless, it's easier to keep it going once it started than to get it started. Especially as the season begins to drag on without a win.
Are we still waiting for our first win?
Probably. And there are changes in those teams, especially UAE Emirates. I think there's some quite a lot of changes at that team on the management side that could well have an impact on the road. But Gaviria is obviously a guy who should win races for them. Now, just before we go this week, since we are talking about Katusha Alpecin, one of their new signings for this year is Harry Tanfield, the young British rider who was part of the Hoob Watt Bike setup last year. We featured Hoob Watt Bike in last week's episode, of course. And Lionel, you chatted over the phone to Harry Tanfield, didn't you, before he made his debut for Katusha Alpecin?
I did, yeah. He was in Mallorca, just getting ready to make his debut in two of the Challenge Mallorca races. He didn't finish either of them, but he was looking forward also to the Volta a la Comunitat Valenciana, or Tour of Valencia, as we used to call it in the old days. And, well, he kind of backed up what Daniel was saying about the way Katusha picked their teams at shorter notice, because he'd only just found out that he was going to be riding the Valenciana race, and he was keen to see how he measured up against some World Tour riders in the time trial. What's the step up been like? Has it been noticeable? I mean, is the training different, harder? Yeah, what's, you know, what are the differences?
It's different. Like, obviously, you know, everyone trains hard. It's just different to what I've done in the past, really. The thing is, when you're training at a lower level, you're training for races that are a lower level as well, so they're not, you're not training to ride the bike, you're not training to race for 6 hours, you're training to race, you know, four and a half hours, just real hard, rather than opposed to multiple back-to-back, you know, days, rather than just one-day races and stuff. Just like your resilience to fatigue, really, I think. It's just being able to tolerate the load. I mean, it's just a lot of time pedaling a bike. There's no other way around it, so.
And what about the first race? I mean, are there any butterflies, a few nerves? I mean, you're not starting with the first of the Challenge Mallorca trophies. You're coming in what, to the second or third one? What's the plan? And I mean, would you prefer to get right stuck in?
The second day, I mean, yeah, it's a 4 day race, and obviously it's 4 1 day races, so it's pretty much just every guy gets a race, gets a ride out. Everyone in the team's going to do a couple of days, and everyone's been set sort of 2 days for their program. It's just whatever really fits. Of who's doing what. Day two is, I'm just going to get absolutely slaughtered, so just there to get around. Really, I don't know what's going to happen.
So you're under no illusions. It could be quite a tough first day as a World Tour rider. What have you got on the agenda for the rest of the spring? Do you know yet?
Oh, yeah. Day two, I'm 100% getting dispatched. Just at what point? and then after that, well, I don't know. We've been talking about the programme, obviously, and I thought I was racing sort of 15th, 16th, but by the sound of it, I'm racing maybe Valencia in a few days' time. So, which was news to me this morning. So, gonna go and have a chat with the DS and the other guys tonight. Actually, and just go and find out exactly what the crack is, basically, because I didn't know I was riding.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.